This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, August 9th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Question, is it playing Kim Jong-un's game of threats or remember mutual assured destruction from the Cold War? Would we call this commentary from Donald Trump, our president, the rhetoric of assured destruction? Listen.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. He has been very threatening beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before.
You've no doubt heard this dire warning by now. Kim Jong-un certainly heard it. North Korea's army responded, saying it was, quote, carefully examining the operational plan for making an enveloping fire at the areas around Guam with medium to long-range strategic ballistic rockets. How should Americans feel about all this? Well, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was asked that on Guam during a stop there today.
I think Americans should sleep well at night. I have no concerns about this particular rhetoric of the last few days. I think the president, again, as commander-in-chief, I think he felt it necessary to issue a very strong statement directly to North Korea. But I think what the president was just reaffirming is the United States has the capability to fully defend itself from any attack and defend our allies, and we will do so. And so the American people should sleep well tonight.
We should note, Guam has been a U.S. military asset since World War II, and in an eerie confluence of history, Donald Trump's warning comes almost exactly 72 years after the nuclear attacks on Japan that were launched from Tinian, which is part of the Mariana Island territory in the Pacific that includes Guam. Some voices from Guam will think about then and now for us in just a moment, but Joel Witt, senior fellow at the U.S. Korea Institute at Johns Hopkins University, is back with us. Joel, you predicted on this program last time an escalation of the trading rhetoric from North Korea and the White House. I guess you've got it now. What do you say?
Well, what I say is this is perfectly predictable. The administration has not been moving quick enough to deal with this problem. And as a result, the North Koreans are moving forward with very threatening programs. And we need to really have a sense of urgency about dealing with this issue that goes beyond threatening rhetoric.
So does North Korea have the momentum, have the upper hand at this point, rhetorically and, I guess, tactically at this point?
Yes, I would say they do have the upper hand, and they've had it for months now. The point is, regardless of U.S. sanctions and U.N. sanctions, regardless of President Trump's threats, and regardless of the occasional movement of U.S. military forces to the peninsula, North Korea's programs continue to move forward. And the issue still is, what are we going to do about it?
On your website, 38north.org, what are people saying? Are we in a new territory? Are we looking at an episode of rhetorical kind of peak to be followed by a valley?
Well, you know, we have a lot of technical analysis about their missile and nuclear programs. And I think the point there is that this has been a steadily mounting threat that's been going on for years. And now it's reaching a point where it's actually threatening the United States. And this was entirely predictable months and years ago. And secondly, in terms of the threatening rhetoric, you know, from my perspective at least, what North Korea is doing is just standard operating procedure. They're amping up the threats a little bit because of what President Trump is saying. But this is nothing new. North Korea threatens the United States constantly in its official media. So I think we need to calm down a little bit while recognizing this is an urgent problem.
Let's look at the urgency part. Would you buy the Washington Post's story that suggests that intelligence within the Trump administration, that even goes back to the Obama years, would give the North Koreans the capability of missile-ready nuclear devices?
Well, that's a good question. And of course, none of us knows for sure, even the U.S. intelligence community. What I would point out is that the Washington Post story is based on an estimate by the Defense Intelligence Agency, which typically is very alarmist about foreign threats.
And doesn't have a great track record here.
Doesn't have a great track record. And the point here is that the U.S. intelligence community is made up of a number of different agencies who regularly get together, they discuss issues and come to some common conclusion. So I don't know what the common conclusion is. But having said all that, this is a very dangerous situation, and we need to focus on dealing with it in a practical way.
Donald Trump tweeted this morning that the United States nuclear arsenal was one of the first things he addressed coming into office, and that now it's more powerful than ever. I have a little bit of doubt that such a change could happen overnight in the way that he describes it, but it begs the question, do people use North Korea to essentially compel policy changes, to basically get more money put into nuclear modernization, for instance, independent of whether there's an actual threat going on in the Pacific?
Well, I think the North Korean threat is particularly important for those who advocate building up missile defenses, both in the region and the defenses of the United States. Beyond that, even today, we have sufficient nuclear firepower to destroy North Korea. I mean, we don't need modernization just to do that. So I think the modernization program is more aimed at countries like Russia and China, who are also building up their nuclear forces.
You mentioned the anti-missile capability. Bill Cohen, the former Secretary of Defense, said today that what needs to happen is a comprehensive and staged effort to install anti-missile systems in the Pacific among our allies, South Korea and Japan, and then move ahead on sanctions to suppress not only the North Koreans' ability to threaten, but also to basically shut down their capability altogether. Would you agree?
Well, I think those programs would be part of a bigger strategy. But I think we also need to understand that all of that is not going to stop the threat. Even an anti-missile defense is not leak-proof. And so the danger will still be there of a North Korean nuclear attack, particularly if they continue to build up their missile arsenal and increase their nuclear stockpile. So we need a comprehensive strategy. And I've been saying this for a long time, as have others. And that strategy needs to include not only measures to protect ourselves, not only measures to put pressure on North Korea, but also starting a dialogue with Pyongyang to see if there are peaceful ways out of this confrontation. Otherwise, the problem is just going to continue to mount.
Joel, before we go, do you believe a North Korea-inspired or motivated nuclear event will happen in your lifetime?
I don't think North Korea is just going to, out of the blue, launch a missile against the United States or our allies in the region. The danger here is that escalating tensions could create a situation where miscalculation results in a second Korean War.
Will that happen in your lifetime?
I don't know at this point, honestly. I think the chances are increasing.
Joel Witt, senior fellow at the U.S. Korea Institute at Johns Hopkins University and founder of the website 38north.org. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Could Guam become a ground zero? Do the people think about it, given their history so close to the nuclear attack that historians say ended World War II 72 years ago? Jefferson Cronin of KPRG Guam Public Radio joins us. Jefferson, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
A lot to think about, both in terms of then and now in Guam there. What are you thinking? And the people you talk to, what are they thinking?
We're kind of used to this on Guam. Of course, not the nuclear part, perhaps, but he threatens us regularly, actually. And so we're kind of used to it. Some people do get upset about it, but most people are not very upset about it because we're very well protected. About 2/3 of the island is a U.S. military base of one sort or another. So we're not really afraid of him. And it's something that especially the older folks here on Guam who went through World War II, and there are still a number of those people here who were captured by the Japanese during the war. You know, Guam is the only substantially populated U.S. soil ever conquered by a foreign power. And so these people are very defiant, and that sort of runs in the blood here.
Well, you also express a certain amount of wisdom in evaluating the rhetoric of Kim Jong-un and possibly even Donald Trump at this point. If you listen to talk radio here in the United States, there are a lot of commentators that are quite strident and loud and fearful sounding about attacks on Honolulu and San Francisco and the rest. Do you have anything to say to them?
Yeah, I'd say chill out, because this feeds the fire, and we don't really need that. We have about 170,000 people here on Guam, and in the northern Marianas, there's another 30 or 40,000, our near neighbors. Most of the people around here that I've been talking to feel like replying to Kim Jong-un's rhetoric with more of the same is counterproductive and even dangerous.
Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, spoke about people should feel safe and not concern themselves, actually expressing some of what you just remarked about a moment ago. Would people in Guam say poor choice of words by the president yesterday? Is chill out advice maybe for the White House?
Yeah, I think a lot of people feel that way. Like, they're asking, why is he doing this? We understand that Kim Jong-un does these things as much for internal political reasons as anything else. He has to keep his power, and he has to play the game internally. And so far, we've done pretty well by not playing his game.
Finally, Jefferson, this is a nuclear week. 72 years ago, the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Does Guam commemorate that in any way? Think about that at all?
Not really. I mean, of course, it was just slightly to the north of us from Tinian, the island of Tinian, where those bombs took off. That's where the planes came from to drop the bombs on Japan. We have on Guam, we have a great relationship with Japan now, and we have a huge Japanese tourism industry here, and many Japanese residents. Really, it's we don't really commemorate that. We just commemorate our liberation from when the Americans came back and took the island back from the Japanese during World War II. And that's the biggest holiday of the year on Guam.
Jefferson Cronin is a morning news host at KPRG Guam Public Radio. Jefferson, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
The Trump administration has made some dire warnings to ISIS in Syria as well as North Korea. Has it delivered on the threat to defeat ISIS? How involved is the U.S. in the war President Trump has pledged repeatedly to win? Who's not winning? Well, there are 5,165,502 registered Syrian refugees who've left the country, according to the UNHCR. Over 7 million internally displaced people and estimates of upwards of 400,000 civilian deaths. In just a minute, we'll hear from one Syrian activist who is preparing for life after war in Syria through the education and empowerment of women. Borzu Daragahi joins us, Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News. He was recently in Raqqa, currently in Istanbul, Turkey. What did you see in Raqqa, Borzu?
I mean, it's a very, very fierce battle to dislodge ISIS from its self-declared capital, of its self-declared caliphate. And, you know, it's a very, very intense fight going on hour by hour, day by day, with Kurdish-led Syrian militias, ground forces, basically punching their way through ISIS positions inside the city. And when they get in trouble, calling in for U.S. airstrikes, or the U.S.-led coalition, actually, also other countries involved in that coalition, especially Britain and France. And you see more and more American military personnel on the ground there helping the Syrian militias fight ISIS, as well as, quite interestingly, regular U.S. officials who are helping in the sort of political and humanitarian process, so that once ISIS is kicked out of this area, there is some measure of stability in Raqqa and surrounding areas.
How effective is all of this? And are the American flags flying, or is it a more subtle but sizable involvement in the war on the ground?
I think it's very effective. I think this is the strategy that has been in place since 2014 when ISIS took over the Iraqi city of Mosul. This is basically a version of that strategy, perhaps much more robust, perhaps much more cooperation between local ground forces and the U.S. Air umbrella. And it is, I think it is working. I think it is effective in terms of a military strategy to get rid of ISIS. I think there's a few concerns. One is the heavy dependence on airstrikes is creating a lot of civilian casualties. And I think the biggest concern, the sort of 800-pound gorilla in the room, is the unresolved political issues that led to this crisis.
So do we save the patient by making Syria a political fatality? What is the outline of a Syrian political solution that you might see in this coalition on the ground? What do the Syrian Democratic Forces want? Do the Kurds have a stake in a united Syria? All these questions are important, but maybe premature with all the fighting going on.
No, I think they're not premature, as we saw in previous conflicts. These sort of political, thorny political problems tend to undo any military successes. The best case, I guess, is Iraq, where, you know, the U.S. managed to invade and topple the government in 2003. And meanwhile, you know, the sort of the kind of chaos it unleashed and the lack of a plan that it showed really led to disaster. As for the patient, I think the patient is, you know, I've been covering Syria now for like it's coming to six years and so on. And I think it's beyond saving. I think it's just such a disaster, such a humanitarian collapse. And I think that, you know, you underscore an important point. The Syrian Democratic Forces, which is the U.S. Partner on the ground in northern Syria, is heavily dominated by the Kurds. And not just any Kurds. These are Kurds who are loyal to the Kurdistan Workers' Party. That's the PKK. The PKK is the Turkish-Kurdish organization that has been fighting the government of NATO partner Turkey for years and is considered a terrorist organization by Turkey, as well as the U.S. and the European Union. And so this becomes really complicated. Is the offshoot, the Syrian offshoot of the PKK, going to establish a little statelet in northern Syria on the border of Turkey? Turkey will not accept that. You know, this makes a lot of people in the region nervous. It makes the government in Baghdad nervous. It makes the government in Tehran, Iran, which also has a sizable Kurdish minority, nervous. It makes the government in Damascus very, very nervous. But it, you know, more than anything, it makes the Turks very, very, very nervous. And the Turks could undermine any potential peaceful settlement to the sort of northern Syria mosaic. And, you know, that's a real concern. The U.S. is constantly trying to massage Turkish worries about what's happening with its partner in northern Syria.
I like your statement, mosaic, in talking about northern Syria. But we could talk about a mosaic that stretches from Basra in southern Iraq all the way to the Lebanese border. Groups that on Sunday, war crimes prosecutor Carla DePonte announced are all bad guys as she was leaving a UN commission responsible for investigating human rights abuses in Syria. Is that the end game here? A kind of pre-Ottoman or Ottoman-era series of statelets all fighting each other full of militias and weapons and no real national outcome?
It does seem that is one overlay. You know, you do have, like, for example, you know, I spend quite a bit of time in Baghdad, and there is a very strong right now Iraqi sense of national identity. I think there's a similar thing in Syria as well. You know, Syria does have a national identity. It does have a history, but you have many groups that don't accept it or want to change it. And this is what wars are fought over. You know, wars are rarely fought over resources. Wars like this are fought when a country basically doesn't know who it is anymore. And a large group of people want to redefine who it is. And I in the past, me and people smarter than me have likened it to the 30 years war in Europe in the Middle Ages, or the pre-Middle Ages, where, you know, you had all these different, you know, Catholic and Protestant denominations and all these foreign powers interfering, all fighting over, you know, what was then, what turned out to be mostly Germany. And this is the mess that you have. Yeah, there are no real good guys, but, you know, on balance, at least for now, those U.S. allies, the Syrian Democratic Forces, seems to be abiding by some decorum. You know, they're probably the best bet in this particular patch of Syria.
Borzoi Deragahi is Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News, recently in Raqqa, currently in Istanbul, Turkey. Borzoi, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Continuing our discussion of Syria and what it's like for people inside the country, and especially civilians preparing for life after war. Maria Al-Abde is with Women Now for Development, an organization led by Syrian women to serve Syrian women. It's based inside Syria, although Maria is in Berlin because so many Syrian women have to work outside of Syria because it's too dangerous. Maria, how are women preparing for life after war?
First of all, they are first trying to survive the war itself. Last week, we lost one of our colleagues who was working on women participation on local election, and she has been killed by bombing. Secondly, they are working and working and working days and nights for everything, starting from child education, going to their participation on election, on decision making. A few days ago, also my colleague in Idlib were preparing a theater for women's theater. So they are working at all levels.
Has the war been an opportunity to begin to reform and move away from issues of honor killings, domestic violence, the marital conservatism that exists in parts of the Islamic world, and you've mentioned education. Is it possible to get beyond some of these obstacles to women's participation in civil society?
Actually, I don't know if I will use war as an opportunity. Yani, war is lots of crime or lots of victims, but it's a new challenge for women, and they are taking this challenge very serious, and they are taking the lead on their family because of the absence of male who has been arrested or killed or other. So it's a new challenge for women, but they are taking this challenge on a very good level.
Let's talk a little bit about something that we've spoken about off air, and that is courageous colleagues inside Syria. Describe some of the work that your organization is doing that reflects that courage inside Syria right now.
When you are talking to a woman or a group of women who are living in a besieged area, when I'm talking about besieged area, you have to understand that there is no water, no electricity, that women are giving birth without any anesthesia, that they have been going through chemical attacks, that they have been seized by their own regime, they have been bombed by their own regimes. There is a presence of armed group. And when you are talking to those women and asking them, what is your priority? They are asking you for curriculum for children because they don't want to see their children on armed group. Just one example of those women.
No one predicts an end to the war anytime soon, but I'm wondering if in your heart or in your gut you feel as though if things do return to some sort of civil order in Syria, that women's view of the future will be, all right, we're going to run things a little bit differently this time around.
Yeah, for sure, but we need the absence of war. I will not call it peace. So women and civilians can more participate. And what women are doing differently now, I think, is to continue the non-violence resistance and raising their voice against all the human rights violation in Syria. The women are there to say, we want the right to every woman, to every people in Syria, from our children, for us as women, for the people who are disappeared or has been tortured. So we need justice for all of them. And I think, and they are doing that without any violence. They are just using their voice, and we are trying to amplify their voice.
You're listening to one of perhaps the largest opposition voice in Syria, the voices of women. Maria Al-Abde is with Women Now for Development. She spoke with me from Berlin. Maria, thank you so much, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
If we flood like this, in a typical New Orleans summer rainstorm? What's going to happen in a hurricane? What's going to happen in a tropical depression?
At a city council meeting yesterday in New Orleans, residents, including Naaman Stewart there, expressed worry and anger about the city's response to a torrential downpour over the weekend, as much as 10 inches of rain in just 3 hours. The Sewerage and Water Board of New Orleans initially said that drainage pumps had been fully operational. Then yesterday, initial claims of success were amended. The only pumping New Orleans resident Andre Boren detected was from Mother Nature.
The water came up in about 30 minutes on my street. It was too deep to be able to drive my car to higher ground, and it proceeded to continue to rise well after it stopped raining, and it didn't go down until about 4 in the morning. So it's about 12 hours of flooding.
Jessica Rosegard is the flood recovery editor for WWNO in New Orleans. Jessica, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Now, describe this extreme flooding versus what happened during Katrina. What does it affect, and how extreme is it, and how are residents sort of thinking about this flooding?
Well, Katrina was, you know, obviously a huge storm. People knew it was coming. They were able to evacuate. And the city flooded basically because of a levee system failure. This was your average August, you know, heavy rain in New Orleans. We get pretty serious storms down here. And the rain had been falling for about 2 hours before the National Weather Service issued their flood warning. They try to issue those only when there is an immediate threat to life and property, because obviously you don't want to cry wolf. But it wasn't the kind of thing where people were going to evacuate. We have a pumping system that is supposed to help keep flood waters at least at bay. You know, streets flood here quite often. Like I said, this was a heavy rainstorm. We got somewhere between 8 and 10 inches of rain in a few hours. And in that case, New Orleans is going to flood. But I think people really were not expecting this at all.
Politically, what's been the response as city officials take a look at what's really happened?
Yeah, it's pretty shocking. You know, the mayor was out of town this weekend, but city officials kept saying, including the Sewerage and Water Board issued a statement saying that all of the pumps were working at full capacity. We have 24 pumping stations and a total of 121 pumps to keep water flowing out of the city in cases like this. And all weekend, they supported their infrastructure, said everything was running as planned. And then yesterday, we had a city council meeting to investigate, you know, well, if everything was working, then why did this happen? And it turns out that a number of pumps were offline for routine maintenance. You know, they are mechanics, they need to be maintained. But it's a real step back to say that things were working at 100% when actually, in a few neighborhoods that took on the most flood water, pumping stations were working at maybe half of their capacity. The fallout has been the director of the Sewerage and Water Board, Cedric Grant, has submitted his resignation. There's a real lack of confidence in that department right now. Mayor Mitch Landrieu has called for the firing of two other officials within that department, and a second person has also submitted his resignation effective later this month. So they're really looking at a crisis of confidence and restructuring that department.
Jessica, a federal report from scientists within the Trump administration, a report that hasn't been issued, by the way, suggests that extreme weather is something that's starting to affect Americans all over the United States, the form of drought, extreme temperatures, and the kind of flooding that you're seeing down there. You've described it as seasonal, but would you say that people in New Orleans are beginning to feel extreme weather as a more or less constant event?
It is a fairly constant event. The storms that we get down here, the thunderstorms roll in quickly. They are very intense. Power gets knocked out. It is just sort of one of those things that you deal with living in this part of the country. But last year's flooding in Baton Rouge, this flooding that we just had in New Orleans, a few weeks ago we had a lot of rain that caused flooding in similar parts of town. It's something that people here have to deal with, and residents here know that. We park our cars up high on curbs when there's going to be flooding. We keep street drains clear. Neighbors will go out and literally clear muck from drainage areas themselves so that they can prevent some street flooding. But it's not something that anybody really wants to have to get used to. You know, cleaning out your home, replacing carpet, having inches of water in your house is not something that people should have to get used to.
Oh, the question is, will they have to? Jessica Rosegard is a flood recovery editor for WWNO Radio in New Orleans, Louisiana. Jessica, thanks so much.
Thank you.
What if crime victims ran prisons? Would they gear up much tougher punishments to achieve an emotional satisfaction as victims, to achieve revenge?
We talked to victims and asked them, would you rather have the person who hurt you incarcerated or have them in common justice? 90% choose common justice. 90%. It's a wild number.
Daniel Sarrett is founder and director of Common Justice, a project operated through the Vera Institute's effort to reimagine prison. She says victims might just release inmates if they ran the overcrowded prisons in this country. Common justice has become an alternative to incarceration that also contributes to victim healing as well as having a meaningful impact on offenders. Daniel Sarrett is a survivor of sexual assault who has also been on the wrong side of the law in her life. She's been trying to get on the right side of justice ever since.
We make two mistakes about victims in this country. One is we tell a distorted story about who victims are. We believe that victims are primarily white women like me, when in fact a young man of color is 10.5 times more likely to be robbed or assaulted. And yet their stories, their experiences, their needs, their preferences are virtually nowhere in the public discourse, nor are they anywhere in public policy. But the second mistake we make is that we believe that victims only want massive punishment. What we find more and more is that in neighborhoods that are not impacted by incarceration, those opinions vary widely about whether prison does or doesn't work. But if you go to neighborhoods where the incarceration rates have been highest, you will be hard-pressed to find anyone who actually believes incarceration produces safety. That's not because they're liberal. It's not because they're prison abolitionists. It's because they're observing 30 years of a pattern that has failed to produce what they were promised. We make that promise in crime victims' names. We say we are doing it for them. We do not do it having asked them what they want. We do not do it with regard for their individual safety. And we continually fail to take into account the overwhelming evidence that this hypothesis that prison would make us safer has been disproven.
So what are the alternatives that you find that work, that actually satisfy these conditions, which you say are so important?
So Common Justice, the project I direct, operates an alternative to incarceration for violent felonies. It's based in restorative justice principles. People who have committed crime go through an intensive screening, intensive intervention, and they enter into a dialogue with the people they've harmed to reach agreements about how to make things as right as possible. And there is something about wanting to face the person who hurt you. There's something almost cowboy about the man-to-man encounter between the people who actually have a stake in the outcome, to say, look at me in my eyes. Answer, how dare you? Who do you think you are? Like, why did you target me?
And that's a connection, not a rant or a punishment per se.
That's right. And it's also, and it can be, it can include rage, it can include anger. And we can feel those feelings and we can honor the legitimacy of those feelings because what happened to people is wrong. And then we can choose a response to that wrongdoing that produces justice, that meets their needs for healing, and that produces safety for everyone else going
and
forward.
And puts the convicted on a path towards being a member of the community.
That's right.
Right.
And puts the person who was hurt on a path toward healing. So the problem with incarceration is not only does it not deliver safety, it does not deliver healing. I think one of the most heartbreaking pieces of evidence for this is if you look at parole board testimony from crime victims who will come 20 years later and say, I feel exactly the same way I did on the day this happened. And we take that to mean that we should continue to incarcerate that person longer, when in fact it is the heartbreaking testimony to us of our societal failure to develop responses to crime that actually put crime survivors on a path to healing.
What in your life gives you insights?
I grew up in Chicago in the time that I now understand historically is when mass incarceration was getting its sea legs. But it's also the last time Chicago saw levels of violence like those it sees today. And I was on both sides of that violence. I hurt people. I survived violence. I lost people I loved to murder. I've survived sexual assault in other contexts. And having been on both sides of that, the thing I know links my experience as a survivor and my experience as someone who has caused harm is on both sides of that, we crave accountability. That's not the same as punishment. Punishment, you just have to be passive. All you have to do is not escape it to be punished. It requires nothing of you. Accountability is different. It requires that you acknowledge what you did, that you acknowledge its impact on others, that you express genuine remorse, that you do whatever you can to make things as right as possible, and that you become someone who will never do that to anyone again. When we've committed harm, it is accountability. It is facing what we've done and fixing it as best we can that allows us to recuperate our sense of dignity and hope and connection and self-love.
Which is different than solitary confinement.
And it's different than prison. Prison is actually in many ways antithetical to accountability. Prison compromises people's ability to be accountable. It creates barriers to that accountability. It creates structural limits to people's ability to do things that would be meaningful to the people they hurt or to make others safer. And so when people who have committed harm see a pathway to repairing that harm, they see a road to their own dignity and responsibility, they understand their connection to the person they hurt, people take that road.
Did you find, as one of your insights, that the criminal justice system treated you differently than African Americans, than other individuals as you faced it?
Unquestionably. So when I was hurt, the pain I encountered was met with care and compassion. And when I caused harm, the mistakes I made were met with mercy. I think one of the things as people with privilege, and in this case, thinking about white privilege, I had the great blessing in its own way as a teenager of seeing that stripped away, right? Of having a case in which the outcome I saw and the outcome my co-defendant saw could not have been more different. And the only difference between the two of us in that courtroom was our race. Hmm. And so what that means to me is, on the one hand, it is my duty to spend my life working to eradicate that inequity, to make an enemy of that inequity and beat it. But the other thing I know from that is that when the system wants to act humanely, it can. It saw me as somebody's child. It saw me as somebody who probably had pain underlying her behavior. It saw me as someone who could be more than the thing I had done. It was right about me, but those things were equally true about all the young people standing beside me in that courtroom.
Including your co-defendant.
Absolutely.
Danielle, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Danielle Sarrett is a survivor of sexual assault, founder of Common Justice, a project operated through the Vera Institute as an alternative to incarceration.
These Marines on patrol made contact with the elusive enemy.
The defense of freedom is everybody's business.
The United States has resumed full-scale bombing of North Vietnam.
American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people.
The Pentagon hoped to instill, quote, shock and awe.
This is a multiple allied interest.
We went into Baghdad, everybody celebrated. And then the war was very badly mishandled.
Reaching across war zones of time was a thought, a gesture, a moment we on this program treasured when we first heard it back on August 8th, 2013. We befriended two U.S. soldiers, one from the Vietnam War, one from Iraq, united by the experience of PTSD. Among the conversations I will always remember from hosting The Takeaway is this one. I suspect it will stick with you, too, long after I'm gone. As part of our focus on PTSD this week, we introduced former U.S. Marine Douglas Howell, who went to Vietnam in 1966 and 1967, to retired U.S. Air Force Captain Mary McGriff, 2004 veteran of the Iraq War.
When I was diagnosed with PTSD and depression in 2005, it was taboo. So even though I knew that I had the diagnosis, I refused treatment because of the stigma behind it. My husband and I knew that I came back changed. I was very depressed, cried a lot, didn't know why. It would just happen. So it wasn't until 6 years after that I actually sought treatment.
You know, half of people who are diagnosed with PTSD don't seek treatment. Douglas, how many times did you refuse treatment, would you say, if you can even count?
Oh, my gosh. Certainly more than five or six or seven, eight times. Nobody ever told me that I had PTSD. I just thought I was kind of a screwed up kid, kind of living on the streets and hitchhiking around the country. I was doing an awful lot of drugs, self-medicating so that I could get through the day and night, and mostly the nights. And I also had a girlfriend and we had a child together. And I came home one day and I saw the child and I didn't like the situation that I had put the child in. And I began to say, I got to get my act together. I had seen any number of psychiatrists and psychologists over the years. Of course, none of them help until you really admit and want help. And you're the one that has to open those creaky doors.
Mary, what are you most curious about Douglas's experience? Go ahead and ask him.
Doug, do you feel like you have made a difference for yourself and for others?
I think that I am very proud of myself for standing up to this very difficult condition and facing it and dealing with it. And I feel like I'm happy to say that I have almost a normal life for having done that. The more I do it, the more I talk about it, the more I become comfortable with the ogre in the room, the more I realize that I would really like to do more for other people. I would like to do more to help find a way for people as myself and as you, Captain, to deal with this so that we don't have to go through that, is this someone I can talk to or is this not someone I can talk to? And how much can I talk about? And how in-depth can I go? And what do I say to them when they say I don't want to hear anymore?
What are you most curious about Mary's experience, Douglas?
I am curious about how she dealt with relationships, whether she has family and children, and how was she able to maintain that?
That was hard. Fortunately for me, and I know for many others, it's not the same, but I have a very strong and solid marriage. My husband has stuck by me since before I came into the military. So we've been married or together for over 20 years. Our relationship really didn't suffer. But what suffered is me struggling with my symptoms and trying to deal with it and be the strong one and be the leader that I'm expected to be. And it was a facade that not only did I have at work, but I had to have it at home. At least that's how I felt. But through treatment, my second psychologist, who was civilian, got me to the point where when she had me write my trauma account of what I experienced during my 4 months, she later then asked me, have you shared this with your husband and your kids? And I was just flabbergasted. I was like, what are you talking about? I would never share this type of detail and emotion with my kids and my husband. And her question was, why not? It was a burden, and I didn't want to burden anybody with it. But she got me through that stage in treatment where I had the nerve to actually read my trauma account, which is 5 pages, out loud to my husband. Then I let my children read it. Then they understood where I was coming from. But I have to accept the fact that I changed. That was the hardest thing. I will never be the Mary McGriff from before September 2004. It's just not going to happen.
Even though I have the effects of war, I'm always leery. I can't go out of my house without the 2 seconds that happen when you open the door. You plan your path to your car. You make it the most expeditious path you can because of that sniper that's going to be out there. Even now, almost 50 years later, it is a brief, fleeting moment, but it happens every single time if I open the front door to get a newspaper. But after that, I'm okay. I can do that.
That is one of the most, difficult challenge is when people think that PTSD is like a rash. It's going to go away. And it's not. So
yes, ma'am.
When people say, get over it, or, oh God, it's been 50 years, you shouldn't be thinking about that stuff already. Those are the people that do not understand. And that is why I have such difficulty talking to people that did not experience what I did.
Any advice for this nation on what we're going to be dealing with over the next 50 years?
It's only going to get worse because you still have people who are afraid to talk because they have their career or their next job to think about. You don't want to be perceived by other people as not being capable of doing certain jobs. You don't want to be judged by your condition. Doug, what do you think?
You know, I come to understand over the last few years that PTSD is not a black and white issue. And PTSD is this great, big, ugly blob of gray.
True.
I don't know what American can do. I think what they can do is listen. Listen.
Douglas Howell was a Marine Corpsman in the Navy during the Vietnam War. He joined us from WDET in Detroit. And retired Captain Mary McGriff was with the United States Air Force serving in Iraq in 2004.
Since the interview, Douglas Howell has written a book about his experiences traveling back to Vietnam to find closure. It's called The Night is Dark and I Am Far From Home, a Vietnam veteran's trip forward into the past. And here's something to take with you today. The voice of Glen Campbell singing his last song, I'm Not Going to Miss You, a personal singing testimony to his struggles with dementia.
I'm still here, but yet I'm gone. I don't play guitar or sing my song.
It's a struggle that ended yesterday. Songwriter, rhinestone cowboy, guitar virtuoso Glen Campbell. He finally got to Phoenix, you might say, dead at 81. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Goodbye, Glenn. This is The Takeaway.
You're the last place I will recall. And best of all, I'm not gonna miss you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.